You should try organic. What about becoming vegan? Don't eat any carbs. How about low carb? Paleo. Keto. Don't eat anything white. Don't forget about the dirty dozen. You eat too little. You eat too much. Don't forget to fast before you work out. I do intermittent fasting. Don't eat after 6 o'clock. Oh my God, sugar? Every day, I'm inundated with opinions. And you know what they say about opinions. Please, don't be foodish. Join me, Amy Goldsmith, owner of Kinder Nutrition and Wellness and dietitian for 20 years, as I talk evidence-based nutrition to get the disorder out of eating. I can't wait to serve you. Okay. Hi, everybody. It's Amy Goldsmith from Don't Be Foodish with my co-host, Kim Coppola.
Hey, Amy. Hey, everyone.
And we are back after a couple of great episodes. I know we got a lot of great feedback about our episode with Caroline Matthews. And I had a bunch of my dietitian nerdy friends who reached out about our talk with Claire last week. And so we've kind of been going through, you know, all the things, where eating disorders come from, how they progress, what treatment looks like, what remission and recovery look like. But I think there's still question sets out there with, okay, well, how do I get started?
Yeah, I think it's been great. We've been able to bring people on who've experienced treatment and navigated the process. But Amy and I want to take today and really break down and kind of reacclimate everyone, if you are seeking help and need support for the first time, like what this process can look like.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have a lot of people who listen to this podcast, and a lot of times I feel like that might be like step one or that pre-contemplation, you know, stage, like, okay, I'm listening to this because I either know a loved one or, you know, live with a loved one who potentially has an eating disorder, or you might be somebody who thinks like, I think I might have an eating disorder. Maybe you're in denial, and it's good because you're kind of getting your toes wet. But I do think that every single instance of delaying that treatment secures and gives strength to the eating disorder.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
Yeah. So we'll talk a little bit about kind of how the process starts in our office. And of course, it can be different everywhere. But I would say we have three forms of how somebody kind of gets started with us. I would say first and foremost, all the pediatricians in the Frederick, Maryland specific area, which is where we're from, if they suspect an eating disorder or unexplained weight loss, unexplained weight gain, they do automatically refer to Kindred Nutrition. Now, I will say a referral does not always equal a call, right? So we do still get lots of parents who say, like, I was referred 6 months ago, or, you know, I heard your name. So they will be referred depending on the physician and how often the physician is following up and how the physician holds their families accountable, really depends on like how people move forward with that. Mm-hmm.
And then we also have parents who maybe have done some research on their own and have stumbled across Kindred Nutrition, or even the third way people come to us is they themselves are seeking out help and, you know, we're doing research online and find that we specialize in eating disorders, and that's how they get to us.
Yeah. So I would say like that second and third are probably kind of clumped together. Mm-hmm. And then really the additional way people kind of come to us are word of mouth. Mm-hmm. And I would say that would be from everywhere. I mean, I have had people referred to me who I've worked with, you know, licensure, of course, is dependent, but with people in New York and people in Texas, these are all places that I'm allowed to practice, and for sure all over Maryland. So to the point that, you know, sometimes parents might recognize or be open and say like, my child's having issues eating, and people say, you know, you've got to go to Kindred Nutrition. So and that's really a nice way too, because usually if they're hearing that from a trusted source that they're friendly with, I would say Those are the calls that I get that I was told about you yesterday and I'm calling today. So that's probably the quickest return, I would say.
Yeah. And I think it helps in terms of treatment success that they already have some buy-in knowing someone who's sought out services here.
Yeah. So usually once people call us, we get, I'm the one who takes all of the calls and kind of screens them just because we're pretty specific in who we work with. And meaning from like the disease state and that sort of thing, I only work with sports nutrition and eating disorders or athletes with eating disorders. And so, you know, I'll have a conversation with whoever's calling, whether it's the parent or it's the patient, and we'll kind of talk about where you are in the status and create that initial appointment. And in that initial appointment, we do have paperwork, dreaded paperwork that we request for people to fill out. And that kind of gets the ball rolling to that first appointment.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, Amy and I will meet together with an initial appointment if it's a child. But due to scheduling issues and it's hard to coordinate that time, it's not uncommon for Amy to meet with someone individually and then bring therapy into it after she's met with them and kind of assess their needs.
Right. And I think it's important for us to kind of pause here and just kind of explain to everybody that we absolutely know that there is a point of nerve with this first assessment, right? I would say from both, if we're talking about children, I would say it's from the parent side and the child side. A lot of times, if the child or the teen or the young adult is in denial or, you know, doesn't really want to get better, they are dreading seeing a dietitian. I mean, they know that they're going to talk to somebody about food. Now, what I find is they have a sense of relief if they go to a dietitian who doesn't have experience in eating disorders, because they're just going to be asked like very general questions and it's over really quickly and they're not challenged. However, sometimes when they're in the meeting with me, you know, I mean, I let everybody know this is a safe space. And if I'm asking any questions that they're uncomfortable with, they can absolutely waive it. I want everybody to feel comfortable. I often see two things. The first is that there's a sense of relief, like this lady actually knows what I'm going through and is asking me the right questions, and I feel understood and heard. And I would say the second thing is the oh shit factor. So all my secrets are probably going to come out here. And just so everybody knows, like, I am trained and know that this is a very nerve-wracking thing to do, and really celebrate bravery. So I talk about that a lot of times for parents who are listening to really understand that, because there are times when I'm talking to parents and they're scheduling where there is, you know, a lot of concern, like, well, if you present it this way, you know, they're not going to be able to, you know, handle it. And I can say there is only one patient that I have saw in 25 years who would not speak to me the first session. And I was even able to get her to communicate with me because I gave her a pad of paper and she was able to write it out. So my whole point of this for parents is to understand that there is a process, and to trust the professionalism of that person. Like, it's absolutely good information for you to kind of present what you think is going to happen, but oftentimes what you think is going to happen doesn't occur.
Right. I mean, from a therapy side, that's a cognitive distortion and jumping to conclusions or anticipating the worst, right? So again, it is normal for parents to have an increase in anxiety as they're navigating this process. And oftentimes they're doing it for the first time. They don't know what to expect. But just because you're feeling anxious about it and worried about how it's going to go, it doesn't mean it's going to go badly, right? Like, that nervousness is normal, and it's not an indicator of how well things are going to go.
Right.
So I really, like Amy said, there's a method to the madness, you know, and if you as a parent or caregiver are able to tolerate that anxiety and kind of like let that method play out, it is reflective of better outcomes in treatment and like trusting us to do our job, because we do this each day, every single day for years and years and years. Like, this isn't our first time doing it, but it may be your first time doing it.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, if you think about it, right, like, I think that any parent's dream, and it wouldn't be my dream as well if I had a child suffering from an eating disorder, is like they go to a dietitian, they're told what to eat, and they magically follow that goal and they're better within, you know, the next day. I know without a doubt that that is absolutely impossible. And that's a pretty strong word for me to say, because I believe anything is possible, but it is absolutely impossible without a doubt for that to occur. And I always kind of try to explain it in the terms of like, how long did it take to create these habits, right? Mm-hmm. You know, oftentimes, like as we peel the onion, we see like, well, it got really bad 3 months ago, but then we look at like 6 months prior to that, like, they stopped eating snacks or stopped eating like packaged goods. And like, you know, 9 months ago, they decided to be vegan, and you know what I mean? So we need to really understand that it was, it took a long time for the patterns to occur. And most mm-hmm. likely there were thoughts and feelings that you had no privy of knowing mm-hmm. that created these strong habits. And so I just say that to the point of, you know, it's really a baby step process to kind of change those habits. So it can be frustrating from some parents, like I'm doing the work and I made the appointment and my child is coming. However, I think we need to kind of hold our horses with that and understand, mm-hmm. you know, there is a method to the madness, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be small, sustainable changes. Because mm-hmm. That's necessary to be able to recover from an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we don't expect that miracle change overnight. And it's important for parents to have a realistic expectation too, that what Amy's speaking to, this is often not just, oh, this started a week ago. It's like, no, this started like 6 months ago or a year ago. Or some people we meet with, they discover it actually started when they were in middle school. Yes. And it was 5 years ago, you know, with negative body image. So think about that. If something's on a path for 5 years, for example, meeting with me or Amy for two sessions, it's a drop in the bucket of what they're really coming to us with.
Right. Absolutely. So then we look at the other confusing thing, I think, with that initial assessment is lots of times I will request ordering additional labs or tests. And a lot of times that can be confusing. And I would say it's taken two ways. Like I have some parents who, and individuals who I'm seeing who feel kind of a sense of relief. Oh my gosh, I've been talking about, you know, not feeling well. And I've been getting, you know, going to these appointments, but not really getting assessed. And then I think it's confusing for some people who may have been seeing other providers and like labs haven't been checked and that sort of thing. And, you know, it's all based off of experience, right? So I specialize in eating disorders. I know how the body works from the moment you smell a food until you excrete it. And I know what starvation and restriction does to a body. So I know what particular labs we need to look at. So you may have labs that are completely normal based off of the comprehensive metabolic panel and the CBC that's ordered. But I know that if I check a ferritin or some of your other inflammation markers, I can see how sick your body is. So I do like to get those markers because that is what I can compare to when I feel like you're in remission and I feel the sense of release. Okay, our body is working well again. And I also usually do recommend a EKG and a DEXA scan for any of my patients that move, especially if they have a low heart rate in my office. And I am going to say this right now, and there's going to be haters out there. I do not believe in the low athletic heart rate. I think it's bullshit. There are, you know, I even think like what Shalane, what is her name? Flanagan. She has her little cookbook, the little cross country runner. She has physical issues because of how low weight she is. And, you know, I don't care how low her heart rate is. You need to fuel your body if your heart rate is low. Mm-hmm. And we know that if you have a low heart rate in my office, that it's dropping when you're sleeping and that you're at risk when you are being active. And I am not going to allow somebody to have a heart issue on my watch. So that is why I do look at those things.
Mm-hmm. And I really encourage parents and caregivers listening to this. Yes, your doctor may have said, oh, but you're an athlete, your heart rate is good. But if you're coming to Amy for specialized advice, I really encourage you to be willing to like sit in that discomfort that your doctor may not be right because they're not specializing in eating disorders. So yes, what Amy says may contradict that medical advice of a doctor, but if they're not specializing in eating disorders, they're not necessarily looking at that low heart rate from that perspective.
Right.
So if, yeah, you're able to tolerate that distress of like, oh, but the doctor said this, they could be wrong, you know, and just
Yeah.
trust, there's a method to the madness and to trust it.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that there are some people who probably do have a low heart rate, and it is okay once you know that they're eating 100% of their needs, they're getting the sleep that they need, you know, their labs are okay. But we know that if you're eating less than 50% of what you need and you're exercising and you've had any type of injury, that you are more at risk of cardiovascular events due to that low heart rate. So those are things that I can order and you can pay out of pocket for, but I usually try to call the physician and have the physician order it, and I usually don't have a problem with that. So I will request it from the physician and we'll look at things from there. And the nice thing about that too is that I get to have a conversation with the physician at that point too. You know, if it's somebody who had never ordered a ferritin before, I get to have that conversation and provide them with evidence-based research articles, and it just kind of strengthens our eating disorder community. So that's why I go ahead and do those types of things.
Yeah, and I think in the assessment, whether from the therapy or even the nutrition side, we're really trying to come up with like their baseline, whether their baseline, like while they're active in their eating disorder, what that looks like, and compare it to maybe where they were at in the past. Like,
Yeah.
and that just helps us assess where they're at so we can help them move forward.
Yeah. So that's usually the first session. And I think a lot of times people feel like, oh, that was a whirlwind. And I do usually give people pointers of what to do like after that first session. Again, it's like very small baby steps. And depending on where I think somebody is clinically, will really dictate how often I see them. So if somebody is clinically struggling, or I know that they're eating like less than 50%, they've had some labs that are abnormal, or they're actively purging or actively overexercising, purging by vomiting or overexercising, that is somebody that I would require to see weekly just because it's unsafe for them to do so. And then sometimes people will kind of go home, try what I'm recommending, and we would go see each other every other week. So that's really kind of where we stand from that perspective. That's all that's usually done at that first assessment.
And then from a therapy side, after doing an intake and an assessment, it really depends on where they're at and emotionally and how stressed they are. And, you know, if they're coming to me after meeting with Amy, I can assess their anxiety and if they need support twice a week, you know, and to tolerate that anxiety as they're implementing the things that Amy's recommending. So that's not uncommon to meet twice a week, or it's typically once a week. It really just depends on the person.
Yeah. And that sounds like a lot. I mean, even as a parent of teenagers, I think about all the things that I'm responsible for those kids, right? Like getting them to their school, getting them to practice, getting the groceries for them, you know, getting their yearly physical and that sort of thing. So like when you hear like, oh my gosh, they may need to, you know, my child may need to go see a dietitian once a week and a therapist twice a week. That does sound like a lot. Or even as an adult who is working and doing all those things for yourself, that sounds like a lot. But I just want everybody to kind of pause and think about that, right? It is technically 2 hours and 45 minutes a day, not counting traffic, or I'm sorry, a week, not counting traffic. So, yes, it does feel like a lot. But in the grand scheme of a 24-hour day, 7 days a week, it is still very, very little support for something that is so strong that it can kill you.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that just speaks to the stigma of, at least for me and mental health, right? Like, no one would bat an eye of exercising 7 days a week, an hour a day, and that's 7 hours for the week, right? But going to therapy once a week, you know, and that's less than an hour, like, that's, oh no, I don't have time for that. But
Right.
people in our eating disorder and exercise obsessed world, like, exercise is not viewed in that same way. It's prioritized. But why would your mental health not be prioritized.
Right. Yeah, it's very interesting. So usually, you know, at that second appointment, like I do a lot of collaboration outside of that first appointment. I'm contacting the physician. I'm getting the last 3 to 6 medical notes. I'm getting their weight history since they were born. Their growth, we call it the growth chart. If they're a child or just like the weight history, if they're an adult. And I had also kind of connected the dots on like what other support systems they have. I would say for about 90% of people who come to Kinder Nutrition, I am the first support system that they have. And so then I know I have to build upon that team. I do not work with eating disorder patients unless they have a therapist. And the reason for that is it is a mental health disorder with clinical ramifications. So they are working with me to become clinically safe, to be able to get to a point where they can receive education and change their mindset around food, because their mindset around food is incorrect. And I know that sounds like very abrasive, but their thoughts and beliefs around food are not factual. And that's what's kind of allowed this disorder to progress. So I will definitely start referring to therapists. It depends on kind of who has openings. It's very easy in my office, like when Kim has openings, to refer to her. But I do work with therapists, you know, all throughout Maryland and, you know, some in Virginia, depending. I would say the key thing is, though, I do require for them to have eating disorder experience. And again, the reason for that is we need somebody who understands that relationship between the thoughts and the feelings and kind of how that comes out and the controlling kind of behavior of the from the food perspective. And they really need to understand like the body image standpoint and the diet culture. There's specific ways you need to kind of phrase things, and you knowing, for example, that like when somebody comes downstairs and like the parents say like you ate really well for dinner, like we know as eating disorder professionals that that is very triggering. Parents, you're not doing anything wrong with that, but we know that that language is triggering. And we've heard like there are therapists who will say things like that. And again, it's not malicious. It's just that they don't have the proper training and with the language and that sort of thing.
And I've talked with therapists who say, oh, but I could help with the anxiety piece and I can help with the depression. And that's all well and good. However, if someone is not fueling their body appropriately and cognitively, right, their brain's ability to function, they're not online, you can't do that work in therapy because they're in this fight or flight response, you know? So, but I think a lot of therapists approach the comorbid diagnoses of anxiety and depression, thinking that that's going to help the eating disorder. And it may sometimes, but really, and I mean, I'm biased, but the diagnosis you really have to treat is the eating disorder, because if you're not getting enough gas in your tank, your car's not going to go. If you're not getting enough gas in your body, you know, your brain's not going to function. You're not going to be able to process the things people are saying to you. So you really have to have that knowledge and that understanding of eating disorders to be able to like approach it in an effective way.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking of like the gas, you know, and the fuel and the, and like for your brain, that's a conversation that Kim and I have often. You know, there are, like I said, I do require for my patients to see a therapist. There are times where I don't refer to therapy right out of the gate. And the reason for that is because I know that their fuel is so low.
Yeah.
Right. And they are in this fight or flight or freeze or collapse. And like, I know that I need to get fuel into them so that they're able to process, because if they're just going to be in this freeze or collapse and they have a stigma against like going to therapy, right, they're, it's not going to work. So, and also I know that for those people whose labs show a deficiency, or they're eating less than 50% and they're still active and have other symptoms, I do know I'm giving them 2 to maybe 3 weeks before I refer them to a higher acuity care. I'm not holding on to anybody in the outpatient setting who is clinically unsafe and doesn't have the support or the ability to try what I'm asking them to do.
Yeah, 100%. And also, if they're not feeling enough, like what they're doing in therapy isn't going to be as effective, and they're not going to be absorbing their medication. So it's really, you have to have like that foundation of like physical stability to be able to do the other stuff. And then in my work with clients, you know, Amy's talking about like assessing their stability. You know, in each and every therapy session, I'm thinking in the back of my head, okay, are they appropriate for medication? Would their symptoms improve with medication? Not, oh, I don't think they can do it on their own, they need medication, but like, I don't want anyone to be suffering any more than the eating disorder already causes. So, this might not be a conversation I'm bringing up every single session of, hey, you need medication. Sometimes it is. I bring it up every single time until that person's, you know, wanting to make that change for themselves. But from the therapy side, that's kind of what I'm assessing. Yeah, do we need to bring a psychiatrist or a psychiatric nurse practitioner in? That's just a piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, and I think that's a really, let's talk about that a little bit, because I would say for the majority of our adults, I think that a lot of them do their own research, like to a detriment, right? Like, so, you know, sometimes not to a detriment, but, you know, for the most time, it's kind of like the over research. And so, you know, so it's a lot of the adults are like, yes, I'm ready for medication. Like, I've already looked it up, but I'm ready for it. But I'm really worried about taking it because of weight gain, right? I mean, I'd say that's probably our biggest response.
No one can see me shaking my head, but absolutely people's biggest concern is weight gain.
And so we will talk through that. I mean, there is a mechanism for weight gain, like with medication, that I think I don't, you know, I've had, again, I would say like maybe two experiences. And, you know, since I've owned here, where people have started to take a medication and gained weight, you know, with no rhyme or reason for it. So it is a thing, but it's very a small thing, right? And when that has happened, like I have advocated like right away, and like we've talked to the psychiatric nurse practitioner to see like if we needed to change the medication. I can tell you with that one person, they felt so much better that it wasn't worth it for them to change the medication. And we kind of just worked through things from there. You know, I think my point of view is it's interesting to me because side effects are listed on all medications, right? And it could be blood clots and brain fog and diarrhea. But the only thing that that person's worried about is weight gain. And I think that that just shows how disordered, you know what I
Oh,
mean?
100%. Yeah, they're not worried about the blood clots or other things that are concerning. They're just worried about the weight gain.
And so, I mean, we will talk through that. And we, of course, have providers that we work with that that can also talk through that. I think, you know, it is a scary thing. A big concern that I have from parents for our younger, you know, our under 18 clients is that they really worry about like just putting them on medication. Is this going to be something they need for the rest of their life? And just like, how is this going to change them?
Yeah, a lot of parents are worried about their child becoming dependent on it. Although I understand, as a parent myself, I understand that concern. However, if a child had diabetes, you would never question putting them on something to help with their insulin. Or if they have epilepsy, you would never question or maybe that's just my bias, but I think I would accept that they would have to be on this medication because it alleviates their symptoms and helps keep them safe and seizure-free, for example. But there is such a stigma on taking any kind of psychiatric medication, even still in 2024.
And I think, you know, when we think about like those examples that you just provided, like with diabetes, we have changes in medications and dosages all throughout the lifespan, you know, for type 1 and type 2 diabetes. I mean, I was a very severe asthmatic, you know, since I was 6 months old, and I can like finally like, you know, run without having to take my inhaler. So I'm making it sound simpler than it is. I feel like if you're super, super concerned about medication, go into our Don't Be Foodish and listen to Mind Over Matter with Dr. Dumitracci. She does explain, she's a psychiatrist, and she explains like that medication can be short term. But I think Kim also has a wonderful way that she explains like how medication can help. Okay. Do you mind explaining it?
Well, thanks, Amy. So I like to think of medication as an umbrella. So let's say today it was raining and you go outside and you don't have an umbrella, you're going to get soaked, right? And oftentimes our symptoms of depression and anxiety and thoughts of eating disorders, it can feel like that. It can feel like this constant downpour on us. So medication kind of acts as an umbrella, right? So you, instead of this constant downpour of those negative thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, the umbrella or the medication acts as an umbrella and kind of filters it. So instead of that constant downpour, you might get splashed here and there. But instead of, let's say, 100 negative thoughts in an hour, you're getting 50, which would feel a hell of a lot better and more manageable than without the medication. So it's not that it changes someone or that they're dependent on it. It can just sometimes take the edge off and allowing them to use the skills that we work on and build on in therapy. It can be a really, really helpful tool for them to use.
Yeah, oftentimes, like when people start their medications, like I'll ask, it does take a while, right? Mm-hmm. So it can take, I think, what is it, like 18 to 24 days, sometimes a little bit more for medication.
Yeah,
to stabilize.
Yeah, sometimes it can be 6 weeks before right. you notice, maybe 8 weeks, depending on if you're fueling your body enough.
Right, right. And so oftentimes, like we'll check in with our patients when they're, you know, taking their medication. I would say the thing that I get from most of my patients, like once they're at that therapeutic dose, is they literally say like, my mind is free.
Yeah. Like I'm just not thinking about food right. as much. And I'm like, oh, well, that must feel a hell of a lot better.
Yeah. And I think that leads to motivation. Mm-hmm. And then it also leads to, okay, we talked about this in therapy, like trying this to ground myself. And like, if they don't have that downpour of those negative thoughts, they can recognize like, oh, this is how I feel before my meal. Kim said that I could try this. I'm going to try it. And then they get that reward of seeing how it works. Mm-hmm. And that begins the process towards remission, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Another thing on the therapy side is I'm also looking out for the benefit of family therapy. Sometimes I like to meet with someone for a handful of sessions before I can really examine, oh, what are some patterns in their family? What's the family's beliefs about food and body image and things like that? So it's not uncommon that I recommend a client to also have family therapy. It's also not uncommon for me to bring in parents or caregivers and meet after, you know, the first couple months of treatment and just see if I can provide them with more education on like the eating disorder side and see if that helps. You know, so just if people are concerned about, oh, well, the therapist wants to meet with me, it's not that you're doing anything wrong or bad. It just might be helpful at that stage in the game to get you involved on the therapy side.
Yeah. And I think it's important to kind of really dig into family therapy, right? Like I think people think it's a negative connotation when we recommend family therapy. And family therapy really is about having that objective person there to help you communicate and problem solve better. Mm-hmm. And honestly, you know, I think every family could benefit from it.
Oh, 100%. I mean,
every family, right?
Yeah.
It is very rare that if you have a family of four or five that everybody has the same exact personality and
yeah.
processes everything differently, mm-hmm. right? And I also think with eating disorders, there's so many feelings, right? I mean, as a parent, you love your child so much and you want to fix this and get them well. And you also have grief or shame because you feel like you missed something.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that is not a judgment. That's what I hear from a lot of mm-hmm. Families. And I think, you know, there's lots of times that we'll do a family meeting here at, mm-hmm. you know, Kindred Nutrition. We don't do them consistently, just from like a time perspective. And almost, I would say the majority of the time, parents are like, this was so helpful.
Yeah.
Right. Because mm-hmm. we'll receive information from the parent, we'll receive information from like our client, or like we'll receive the information from like our client, and then like their loved one will hear things, and we can kind of help process and like communicate it in a different way. I feel like helping somebody recover from an eating disorder is probably one of the hardest things you'll do in your life besides experiencing like pretty severe grief. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a lot of grief, right?
Oh, yeah. I often tell parents that I work with, it's like you're living with a tiger.
Yeah.
And you're like very aware that a tiger is living in your house and you don't want to make a wrong move because that tiger is going to like rip your face off, right? Yeah. It's like you are living with a tiger each and every day, every single day. That's going to be extremely stressful and impactful on the whole family system. So there is no shame in caregivers seeking out help for yourself, starting your own individual therapy, starting family therapy. Like, that's going to lead to better outcomes if everyone within the family has support. And that's not a character defect on the person with the eating disorder. That's just a symptom and byproduct of an eating disorder. It happens to everyone that we work with. Yes. It impacts their family. It's not personal.
Yes.
It just is.
And I would say I would say without a doubt, the family therapy is the number one thing that's missing with the majority of our mm-hmm. clients. So mm-hmm. Which is why we've gotten to the point where we do have to have those like quarterly meetings or so
mm-hmm.
With the goal of kind of helping to problem solve and model. But I think that if families started family therapy sooner,
mm-hmm.
we would probably move towards remission a lot faster.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
a very bold statement, but I really truly believe that with all of my mm-hmm. heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when we talk about, I think the biggest question that I get, you know, when we're setting up that first appointment is like, how long is this going to
be? Last?
Yeah. You know, how often are we going to be, you know, in appointments and that sort of thing? And my response is always, you know, everybody is individual, but I'm pretty honest, like I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's a long process.
Yeah.
It's a very long process.
Mm-hmm.
I would say maybe the soonest I have kind of moved on to like once a month appointments. And then like further than that, it's like maybe 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I have people that I have been working with that I see every 2 weeks, and we've been working together for like 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is not saying that either of those people have character defects or that one was in a position where they were healthier than the other. It's all dependent on their specific disease, how long they have been, you know, dealing with this. I would say the people that I have been seeing longer, we have kind of broke down and said like, wow, this really started when I was 8 years old and like came home and recognized, aww. You know, so
yeah.
Again, it's thinking, you know, we need to think about how long has this formed my self-identity,
mm-hmm.
right? And if it has been years in the making, it's going to be years in the breaking, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, 100%. I have clients that I've worked with for 4 or 5 years. Sometimes we, you know, we start off weekly, we may go to twice a week, depending on where they're at in their eating disorder. And then as their symptoms decrease, they're feeling more comfortable, more confident, like we may go to every other week, and then eventually once a month. But that's not to say when they hit some kind of life stressor, it's not uncommon for them to say, hey, Kim, can we meet more often? Yeah, sure. It doesn't mean you're back at square one. It just means you're going through a stressful like life event, like maybe transitioning to college or you're starting a new job. So it makes sense. You'd want your support system there for you during those times of heightened stress. And then as appropriate, we'll transition back to every other week and monthly. So even though I've known, you know, a handful of my clients, my current clients right now, I've known them 4 or 5 years. It's not that we meet every week. And some we still do, because you can also go to therapy as maintenance, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have to be in active distress each and every day to benefit from weekly therapy and that safe space to process any stressors that come out. I mean, sometimes weekly therapy can be preventative of someone needing a higher level of care. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it really, as Amy said, it depends on the person. And I do think whether you are coming for the therapy side or the nutrition side, denial, like the level in which someone is in denial is also going to indicate how long they're in the treatment process. And I don't say that as a judgment. I just say it to be open and honest and transparent that if someone's in denial, like, yeah, it might take more time for me and Amy to really chip away at that denial and have them be accepting of their eating disorder. So that could impact how long they're in treatment as well. It's not a judgment. It just is.
Well, I mean, it's what Caroline said, right? Like, until she was no longer in denial, she didn't move forward.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And 100%.
So, yeah. So really we talk about kind of remission and recovery. They're two different things. And from my perspective and this practice, somebody is not fully in remission until they have been completely absent of symptom use for 3 months, right? And so that's where, like, you're able to eat freely. You don't feel like you need to exercise. You don't feel like you need to binge. You don't feel like you need to purge. You're not revolving your entire life around, like, how you look or what your body image is like. You know, thoughts are down. That's when we move into remission. And, you know, you may see the dietitian a little bit less at that point, and you may be focusing more on, like, support groups or cooking classes or other kind of resources to kind of really kind of build your tool set. And, you know, really from there, you move into recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And recovery looks different for everybody. But I would say for the majority of our folks, they are still seeing someone and have some sort of rapport with somebody through at least the first year of their recovery.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. I think that you spoke to body image, Amy. I mean, body image is really like the last piece of the puzzle. And because that's often what somebody, what starts their eating disorder, right? This low view of themselves in relation to their body and this low body confidence, like, that's kind of what can start an eating disorder, or at least is kind of in the foundation of it, right? So that makes sense why, yes, you get symptoms under control and you stop those, but you're still going to have to address the body image piece. And that can take a significant amount of time to unlearn all of those messages that our disordered society has thrown out there about our bodies and how they're supposed to look and what makes them worthy. And I mean, that takes significant time. It's not a character defect. It just takes time and practice to unlearn all of that.
Yeah. So this is a little bit of how the process works at Kindred Nutrition. I would say most outpatient facilities probably mimic similar things. I think that we are great at collaboration and team collaboration and making sure that we get, like, the physician and the psychiatrist and
mm-hmm.
family therapy and everybody on board. We really kind of drive that. So hopefully you have that where you are. But I would say if anybody here is listening and they are in that kind of purgatory of, I think I might have an eating disorder, or I may be ready to get started, you know, the hardest thing, the first hardest thing is going to be to make that appointment.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, go into that appointment with an open mind and really fight for your recovery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so hopefully this has kind of helped people understand the process a little bit more, and we'll be back at it in a couple weeks.
See you guys.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us for our favorite hour of the day. We hope you enjoyed our latest podcast from Don't Be Foodish, and we can't wait for you to hear our next episode. If you enjoy our podcast, please help us by rating and reviewing. This allows others who have similar interests to find us. We'd also love for you to follow us, and when you do that, you will be getting the episodes before they are broadcasted on our social media. If you have something that you are really interested in hearing or you'd like us to talk about, please feel free to give us a call at 301-580-0008. We will listen to your messages and hopefully be able to integrate that subject into one of our podcasts this year. Thanks so much, and we'll talk with you soon.